You're listening to A Scary State, and this week we're covering Missouri. So, Lauren?
Yes, Nora.
Let's get scary.
Hello, everyone. We are finally in November, so we hope you guys enjoyed all of our bonus October specials that we had last month. I know we had a lot of fun with them. So now we're back to our states, back to what we do.
Back to our roots.
Back to our roots. Is there anything, any updates on anything?
I don't think so. I'm just kind of excited. Like, I loved doing the special episodes for October, but I'm very excited to be back
in
our normal grind.
It's good to be back to our normal states.
Yeah.
So let's get into the state facts for Missouri. So Missouri, nicknamed the Show Me State, joined the Union on August 10th, 1821, and became the 24th state. It got its name from the Sioux tribe, who went by the name Missouris. Missouri also means town of the large canoes. So some weird laws. If you're under the age of 21, you have a really good excuse to never take out the trash. If there is even one empty alcohol beverage container in that trash, the person under 21 can be charged with illegal possession of alcohol.
Even if they're taking out the family trash?
Yeah, isn't that stupid?
Yes. That's so just extra, really.
Yeah.
That's where the resources are going. Like, what the heck?
It is illegal to honk your horn in Missouri, mainly because it might scare the cows. In Excelsior Springs, you are not allowed to worry squirrels.
Hmm.
Wait, I don't think it's cows. I can't remember what I wrote. It's either horses or cows that you'll scare if you honk your horn. I can't remember, but it'll scare some animals, so you can't do it.
Okay.
And Missouri also has that stupid brothel law. I think Virginia also has it, which says that four or more unrelated women are not allowed to rent an apartment together.
What?
Because it could be considered a brothel.
That is so sexist.
I know. So we can have a frat house with like 20 guys.
Ew. But
heaven forbid you have a house with more than four girls. Missouri also has one of those weird gravity hills where if you put your car in neutral, you will start to roll uphill.
Oh. One of those.
In 1994, the KKK applied to sponsor a part of Interstate 55, which goes through St. Louis County and Jefferson County. The state legally couldn't refuse the sponsorship, but they were able to name the section of road, so they named it Rosa Parks Highway. When asked how she felt about having a road named after her, Rosa Parks said, "It is always nice to be thought of."
Aww.
When did she die? Oh, okay, 2005.
It's so crazy.
Can you believe how recent that is?
I know.
Jeez. Oh, this one's so gross. A family in Missouri bought a house, but ended up suing the family they bought it from. Why? Oh, because brown recluse spiders started, quote, bleeding out of the walls.
Ugh.
It was estimated that the house was infested with 4,500 to 6,000 of these spiders.
I would have sued, too.
The house would have been burned down.
Ugh.
I cannot.
Mm.
Missouri has a devil's chair located in the Highland Park Cemetery in Kirksville. Known as the Bard Chair, it says that if you sit in this chair on Halloween, during a full moon, or any day at midnight, you will either be punished or rewarded for that bravery. Another legend about that chair says that a hand will come out of the ground, grab you, and drag you to hell.
Mm.
So according to research from Radford University and Florida Gulf Coast University, Missouri is in the top 12 states with the largest number of serial killer victims at 311 since 1900.
Wow.
Missouri also has 7 identified serial killers.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. So Nora, what are you telling us today about Missouri?
So I'm going to tell you about the murder of Ken Rex McElroy.
Okay.
So Ken McElroy was born in 1934 to Tony and Mabel McElroy and was the 15th of 16 children.
Jeez.
I know.
Jeez.
A lot. He lived in Skidmore, Missouri. Ken dropped out of high school around the 8th grade, and it didn't take long for him to start breaking the law around age 13. First, it started off with him hunting raccoons, which I don't, like, think alone is, like, illegal, but I think... I don't know if he didn't have a permit. I don't know. But that's what, like, sources were saying was the first bad behavior.
I feel like that's just, like, the herding animals.
I think so. I think he probably was inhumane about it.
Yeah. I feel like you can't hunt raccoons, though. I don't know.
Yeah.
Are there raccoon
hunting laws?
It's just
weird. Like, why?
Yeah, it is odd.
Why was he doing that at, like, 13? I don't know. So that is kind of odd. But then it escalated into petty crime until Ken became a full-on criminal and would steal items like grain, alcohol, gasoline, antiques, and even livestock.
Jeez. And wait, what year was this? I'm sorry.
So he was born in 1934. So this is like the 40s at this point.
Okay.
He would sell the stolen livestock for cash, and because of that, he often had a ton of cash on him.
Resourceful.
Yeah. Pretty soon, everyone in town knew who Ken was, obviously not for being a kind, compassionate person, but instead for being the town bully. To give you more of a description of Ken, he was a big man, about 270 pounds, and had thick black eyebrows and bushy sideburns.
Jeez.
Yeah, and he had, like, cold, beady eyes.
Uh-huh.
And he would always carry a gun.
Good.
And to look at his character, he fathered more than 10 children with at least 3 different women.
Wow.
He got married at least 3 times, with a woman named Trina McLeod being his 3rd and final wife.
I don't like how you say final.
Yeah. Ken met Trina while married to his 2nd wife, Alice. Trina was 12 years old when he met her.
Oh my gosh.
12.
That's disgusting.
He became infatuated with her, and eventually he started to rape her. And she ended up pregnant, and in order to avoid statutory rape charges, he married her when she was only 14 years old.
I feel like that's still illegal.
Yeah, you can't, like, what? You
like,
can't
I feel just... like that's not the way around the law.
Exactly.
I don't
so
like that.
So weird. So back to Ken's other crimes. Ken committed felonies, including assault and arson. In all, Ken was indicted 21 times and managed to escape conviction every time.
Jeez.
He was the Houdini of crime, and he planned his victims just as a bully would. According to author Harry McLean, who wrote a book about Ken's story called In Broad Daylight, Ken knew which people to pick on, the weak people, and he followed through on his threats just often enough to make people believe he was going to do what he said he was going to do. The author is also quoted saying that he didn't have a bank account, didn't have a social security number, and he didn't read. So how could this, like, uneducated person outwit the criminal justice system for 20 years? Well, it once again leads back to bullying and threats.
Mm-hmm.
Often, witnesses changed their mind about testifying before trials began, and if a case did make it to trial, a juror might open the mailbox to find a rattlesnake.
Oh my God!
He would terrorize people.
Oh my God, I would never want to be on a jury for him.
I know. And he had no shame or guilt. So, I mean, I don't know. We'll get more into it, but I think that's also kind of a fault of the system.
Yeah.
Because why is he getting away with this?
Yes. Yeah, he shouldn't be getting away with any of this.
Exactly. Ken would intimidate anyone who got in his way, usually by repeatedly harassing them or threatening them with a bullet. His attorney, Gene McFadden, said he routinely defended Ken in 3 or 4 felonies a year. Felonies, like not
a
even...
A year?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not even counting the misdemeanors.
Wow.
Yeah. McFadden said that Ken was, quote, the best client I ever had, end quote.
What does that mean? What, like someone who kept him in business?
Exactly.
Ew.
Isn't that sick?
That's horrible.
That's horrible.
Oh my God, I have the funniest story that reminds me of, not what? Because this reminds me of something funny, but so my grandma, she was talking to one of her friends,
uh-huh.
and her friend has decided to donate her body to science when she dies.
Uh-huh.
And so she like talked to the people there. They had a great conversation. Mm-hmm. She told them like what bones she wanted them to be like careful of. It's just like funny.
Aww.
But so they're like, well, we can't wait to see you.
Oh my gosh.
It's just very funny. It's such dark humor,
that
but it was
is dark.
So funny.
Oh my gosh.
That just reminded me, like, you know, best client, can't wait to see you. Okay, sorry.
McFadden said in an interview that Ken was punctual and always said he didn't do it, and he paid in cash and kept coming back. The cash that he freaking stole from people, or stole the livestock or whatever and got cash for.
He sounds so sketchy.
I agree. It's like Better Call Saul.
Yeah.
That's who I think of, like, just so sketchy.
Yeah.
So I do not like Gene Kinsler.
Yeah, Gene seems also really sketchy.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that he, like, knew that he was accepting dirty money because mm-hmm. he has to know what's going on to defend Ken.
Oh, yeah, because yeah. he's getting all the information in order to defend him.
Exactly. Gene was basically a dirty lawyer from Kansas City who didn't really seem to have any strong morals when it came to having Ken as a client. And then Ken made Gene's pockets very fat, so both parties were happy, and together, Ken stayed out of trouble and Gene was rich. The town, on the other hand, despised Ken. So the only person who doesn't is Gene. Everyone mm-hmm. else hates him.
Well, yeah, because he's the only one pretty much benefiting from
exactly. him. Exactly. He had been terrorizing Skidmore for years and kept getting away with it. Things reached a boiling point in 1980 when Ken got into a confrontation with the town's elderly grocer, Ernest Bo Bowenkamp.
Oh.
I'll refer to him as Bo.
Okay.
I love Bo.
He sounds so sweet.
I know.
Ernest Bo.
I know. It was so hard reading about this stuff
oh,
that
no.
I'll tell you about. So the confrontation was over something so petty It was over penny candy, which I think is like super cheap candy they sold at the counter. Mm-hmm. Apparently there was a misunderstanding and Ken and his wife, Trina's 4-year-old daughter, was accused of stealing penny candy. Trina was at the store when the daughter was questioned by the grocery clerk, and she knew who would terrorize the entire grocery store for accusing her poor, innocent 4-year-old of theft. Mm-hmm. That's right, she went home and told her husband, Ken the Bully, that the grocery store harassed her daughter about the theft.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I can already, like, tell where this is going.
I know. And also, like, how messed up is that daughter going to be?
Yeah.
Thinking that she never does anything wrong? Like,
yeah.
With that, Ken made everyone who worked at the grocery store's life a living hell. He would show up at Bo's house and just stand outside and watch him and his family. He would go to the grocery store and scream at them. Ken literally terrorized Bo and his family, and the store clerk who was involved in the incident said, quote, "I didn't even accuse his daughter of stealing." So it was like a total like miscommunication. Maybe she, I mean, who knows? She could have been like, hey, like, make sure you give that to your mom so she can pay, you know? Like,
yeah, something as innocent as yeah. that. Yeah.
Ken wound up shooting Bo in the neck.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Over something. Oh my God.
Yes. And it nearly killed him. And everyone in town seemed to know that Ken was guilty, yet he spent only one night in jail. And he almost killed Bo.
Does he have, is he friends with, the cops or something?
I think he has a really good lawyer, and the system was just messed up here.
Jeez.
Like, they were not doing a good job convicting him of stuff.
And it was kind of back then.
Yeah.
But still.
The 50s, but still. So everyone in town seemed to know Ken was guilty of this crime, yet he spent only a single night in jail for nearly killing the man.
Yeah, that's horrible.
I know. But no one was surprised. 4 years earlier, Ken had shot a local farmer, Romaine Henry, in the stomach and got away with it. But it seemed like this time there might be some justice. Shortly after Bo was shot, Ken was arrested and charged with attempted murder. In the months before Ken went to trial, Bo and his family went to bed scared and woke up frightened and lived in terror.
Aww.
Because even like waiting for mm-hmm. everything to happen.
Yeah.
They slept in shifts with some friends or family members keeping an eye on the street.
Oh my God. That's not a way to live.
Yeah. There were many nights that Bo couldn't go out and mow the lawn or water the flowers because there was a truck parked down the street and they were watching the house.
Oh my God.
And they, as in Ken and Trina, would sit in the car and just stare and watch them and like intimidate them. And this is like leading up to the trial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So again, witness intimidation. Yep. Why is no one stopping in or stepping in, you know?
He should be held before the trial or something.
Yeah. An attempted murder, like, I mean, I don't know. It didn't say anything about bond. It's just insane, like, that he was only held for one night in jail.
It would be helpful if we knew what the laws were like back then.
I know. It's just
because I feel like things are a lot different now. But
yeah.
Like, one night in jail for attempted murder, like, it's like, that's doing nothing.
Exactly. Ken would even pay local kids for information about who was where in town and what time. So Bo and his family decided to develop their own network of informants.
Okay, so Joe just got me started watching One Tree Hill.
Yeah, I love it.
Okay,
love
so you know Dan, the dad?
Yeah.
This is giving me very strong, like, Dan vibes.
Yeah.
You know, he's always everywhere and he always knows everything. Mm-hmm. And he's, like, super intimidating.
Yeah, I could totally see that.
Yeah.
But they would deliver messages in code to Bo. For example, one of the owners of the D&G Tavern would send her young children to the grocery store for paper towels. And the children would be completely innocent and unaware that they were telegraphing an urgent message for Bo and his family to call the police. Ken was in town and behaving belligerently, so it was like a warning that they would send whenever he was around.
Wow.
Yeah. Finally, after months of terror, a trial took place the following year, and for the first time ever, Ken McElroy was convicted.
Good. Mm-hmm. Finally.
But unfortunately,
Nora,
the victory was short-lived. Ken appealed the case and was released on bond. Once freed, Ken didn't just quietly celebrate his victory.
Of course not.
Of course not. Instead, he continued to harass Bo. He showed up to the town's local bar armed with a rifle and bayonet, which is a blade that people attach to the end of a rifle.
Yeah.
And Ken threatened to kill the elderly man. He is literally elderly. And Bo had just barely escaped death after being attacked by Ken, and now it's like the guy is out there literally trying to kill him again.
I hate him.
I know. Beau's daughter, Cheryl Hudson, was later quoted saying, quote, "We were so bitter and so angry at the law letting us down that it came to somebody taking matters into their own hands," end quote. So the townspeople held a meeting. In what could only be described as a vigilante justice, they conspired to kill Ken McElroy.
Okay.
I know. I mean, they're protecting Beau for his life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Allegedly, even the mayor was in on it.
Dang.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. My guess is that the mayor was like, I'll turn a blind eye, yep. You know?
Our RA in college was like, as long as I don't see you doing anything bad, I can't get you in trouble.
Yeah, like at least plan it well so that it doesn't come back on me.
She pretty much said, like, you know, if I'm looking the other way, that might be the time to come into the dorm.
Exactly.
She was wonderful.
So they had this meeting and they followed through on the plan. On July 10th, 1981, it was a sunny, clear summer day. It was the day after Ken threatened Beau at the tavern. Ken was getting into his pickup truck with his wife, Trina, on the main street of Skidmore when there was a crowd of 50 people. And, like, reading this, I'm like, did Ken notice the crowd?
Right? Or like, was he just, like, too oblivious to be like, oh, there's people here?
But he sat in his truck, and he was shot several times and hit twice in the back of his head.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they completely ambushed him. He died in his truck at the age of 47, and nobody called an ambulance besides Trina.
What happened to Trina? Was she completely unhit? Like,
so
uninjured?
I read that, like, some people took her away, like, right before it happened. Yeah, they, like, grabbed her and took her away, and they quickly did. Like, it was very quick, and then they shot him in the back of the head.
Wow.
Yeah. Which, damn. I'm like, maybe she wasn't as bad as Ken, and they probably didn't want the kids to be, like, orphans.
Yeah.
But she wasn't great either. But yeah. She did have a traumatic childhood, so I'm like, okay, I get why they didn't hurt her. But
dang.
Yeah, she definitely stirred the pot. So of the 30 to 50 witnesses, no one would name a shooter. Everyone claimed that they didn't see who fired the shots. The DA declined to press charges, and the following investigation proved to be pointless. Nothing was ever uncovered during the investigation.
Wow.
Not even the gun.
Wow.
Or guns, because it was
multiple. Yeah.
And there were no witnesses, so nobody was able to take the stand.
Dang.
Yeah. It's been 40 years since Ken's murder, and no one has ever been charged. And then Gene McFadden, who kept Ken out of jail 21 times, his lawyer, said that the town got away with murder.
I mean, they did.
Yeah. But it's just such a big case of the system failing.
And
It's like, if the system isn't going to protect people, what are they supposed to do?
Yeah, then what are, like, they there for?
Yeah, there were so many cases of people just being completely terrorized by this guy and nothing would happen.
Jeez.
Yeah, and there's actually a 6-part TV docuseries that was on, like, the Sundance Music Festival. It's called No One Saw a Thing, and it's about this.
Oh, I bet that's really good.
Yeah, so I want to look it up.
When we finally get around to watching Woman in the Window.
I know. I think about that, like, every day that we need to watch that.
I know. I'm really sad we haven't watched it yet.
I know. It's bad.
Because, I mean, I've heard it's not great.
But you still want to watch it.
Because we read the book.
Exactly.
We have to.
So we have, like, something to compare it to, like, bringing it to life, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, that was a good one, Laura.
Thanks.
That's so crazy. I mean, it's so bad that the town killed him, but, like,
it is.
But at the same time,
like, they were fighting for their lives, though.
Yes.
And this poor man, like, he was an elderly man. His family was completely terrorized.
And how the town all came together.
I don't know.
It's
even
bad,
the mayor.
But it's, like, cute.
Even the police were like, we won't, like, do anything.
That's wild.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
All right, so I am also covering a murder.
Ooh.
So it was a nice day on June 28th, 1990 in Bridgeton, Missouri. People were coming to eat at the Casa Gallardo Mexican restaurant. And
I
all
love
was,
Mexican food.
I do too. And all was normal. That is until a human skull was found in the bushes outside of the restaurant by two flight attendants. Police were called and the skull was collected. The police determined it to be an adult woman's skull of recent origin. Police Chief Walter Muttert said this about the scene. Quote, "It's a very well manicured area, plants and gravel and what have you. And the way it was situated, it would give one the impression that, you know, someone put it there so you would see it. During that time period, there was the relocating of a cemetery that was in the area, and a lot of bodies were being exhumed, graves were being moved. So it gives you the impression now that this may be a prank, and there would be no reason to suspect that there was any foul play. So because there had been no crimes connected to the skull and the nearby cemetery relocation, the cops had no reason to suspect foul play, which is why the skull was placed on a shelf in the county's morgue, and that is where it sat.
Wow.
So now let's rewind back to October 19th, 1958, when Linda Sue Lutz Sherman was born to parents Walter Henry Lutz and Eleonora Myrtle Busmeyer Lutz.
Whoa. Wait, how long before was this from, like, when they found the skull?
50.
So, like, a long time.
32 years.
Gotcha. Okay.
Is that the right math? Yeah. She was the youngest of four, with all of her siblings being older than her. She was a quiet, sheltered, and reserved child growing up. Linda met Donald Eugene Sherman while she was still in high school. The two got married on February 10th, 1975, shortly after Linda became pregnant with the couple's only daughter, Patty. But Linda was a determined woman, and even though she just had a child, she was determined to finish school, as she was only 17 at the time. Hmm. And that is exactly what she did. Linda completed her senior year of high school and received her high school diploma.
Good for her.
Yeah. Her and Don were still married, but the relationship between the two wasn't a good one. It was often described as being stormy. Linda was a recent high school graduate and worked many different jobs, like a sales associate at Sears, working at Site Oil Company, and working as a cocktail waitress at Flaming Pit Restaurant, while Don was working at a gas station as an attendant. They were working opposite schedules and were having money issues, which, no surprise, added even more strain to their relationship. They would break up and make up, often through the years of their relationship. Linda's family said that Don was overly protective and physically abusive to Linda. He would always want to know where she was. Linda's brother Dennis said, quote, Don was very possessive of her. She said, when I get off work, if I'm not home within 5 minutes, he wants to know what's going on, who are you seeing, what you doing out there late. He's always hitting her and things just weren't right, end quote. Things have been getting so bad that Linda filed for divorce in October of 1977.
Good for you, Linda.
But by November, the two had settled their issues again and were able to... I know, I hate hearing it. And were able to relocate to a nicer and bigger house in Vineta Park, Missouri. Things were going okay for a little bit, other than the occasional arguments and bickering that would occur. The family was finally adjusted to this bigger home, and in 1982, Linda and Don decided that they wanted to expand their family and have another child. So a little trigger warning here, Linda got pregnant but unfortunately had a miscarriage. This obviously took a toll on her and her health began to decline. She was later diagnosed with epilepsy and ended up suffering from seizures. They had to make the tough call to not try for any more children. But after this tough decision, Don's attitudes toward Linda began to worsen and they began to start arguing more and more. Linda believed that at one point, Don had been tampering with her vehicle, like making it dangerous to drive. Mm-hmm. In her mind, that thought was confirmed when Don threatened to kill her, their daughter, and himself. These events, all added up, led Linda to filing a restraining order against Don. They went to court, and the judge granted their request, so Linda took Patty, and the two of them moved into an apartment in St. Anne. But in typical Don and Linda fashion, they reconciled and moved back in with each other.
Oh, that's a cycle of abuse.
I know, right there. It really is. So throughout their whole 10-year relationship, Linda had actually tried to leave Dan multiple times. But on April 11th, 1985, Linda filed for divorce for a second time. She was planning on taking her daughter Patty and moving out of their home in Vineta Park. Linda had been saving money and had been looking for a place for her and Patty to move. She even changed her mailing address to have to spend less time at the house. On April 22nd, 1985, 11 days later, at 2:16 a.m., Linda was coming home from her job at the U.S. Government Records Center located in St. Louis, Missouri. She arrived home around 3 a.m., and right when she got home, her and Don got into an argument. Mm. Don had been waiting up for Linda, and when she returned home, he started bombarding her with questions about where she had been and why she had taken so long to get home. After their argument, Don went to bed in the master bedroom, and Linda fell asleep on the couch in the living room. The next morning, Don woke up and did the dad thing by taking their daughter Patty to school, which was actually very out of character for him because it was always Linda who took Patty to school in the morning. Patty remembers that this was very weird and she was surprised. What she was even more surprised about was the fact that Linda didn't wake up and say goodbye to her before she left for school. Patty does remember that her mother didn't move as her and her father were leaving. Don said that he went to work that day, blah, 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 then returned home that night around 6 p.m. He said that when he arrived home, Linda was home, which was odd because she should have already been at work. He also said that Linda seemed to be on edge and acting odd. The two barely talked and Linda left for work shortly after. But she never arrived at work and was never seen again. Apparently, when she didn't arrive home when she should have, Don didn't think anything of it, as her not returning straight home had become a common event. But I thought this was weird to me because we saw a few days ago he got mad at her when she didn't show up right after work. And now all of a sudden he's not worried. He's
fitting it to, you know, be convenient.
Right. It's very odd. Linda was a very reliable worker and a devoted mother. So when she didn't show up to work and didn't come home, people immediately started to worry and it immediately seemed like foul play was involved. She hadn't contacted anyone over a day, and her family found out what was happening. They immediately urged Dawn to call the police and report her missing. Mm-hmm. It took him 2 days to call the cops.
Oh my gosh.
An investigation began and a search started. Linda's family was also searching on their own, trying to find their daughter and sister. Sam and Fran, two of Linda's family members, were the ones to find Linda's yellow 1971 Volkswagen Beetle abandoned at the Lambert Airport. Inside the car, they saw her school books, her hat, and other things that were hers. The car was marked to have been parked there on April 24th.
That's my birthday.
I know. But sadly, there was no other evidence inside. And what was super creepy was when I was reading this, they said that the trunk was locked. And so they opened the trunk, like, thinking they were like, she has to be in the trunk. Mm-hmm. But they opened it and she wasn't there. But that's such, like, a scary thing to, like, you know, think.
Yeah, it is.
Soon after, the police began interviewing and questioning Linda's family and friends. What do you keep looking at?
Oh, I just feel like there's, like, shadows over there.
Stop, because I keep...
See, like, a light just turned on. Like, it's, like, movement over there.
Oh, my God, I saw that, too. I guess it's someone's Halloween decor.
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, I just saw that in the window.
Sorry,
it keeps
catching my eye.
Well, you keep, like, looking, and I'm like, is Ian coming down the stairs?
It keeps catching my eye.
Okay. All right. That scared me. All right. Soon after, the police began interviewing and questioning Linda's family and friends. Apparently, her family had suspected that Linda had been having an affair, and it was actually confirmed by law enforcement later. I don't know how it was confirmed, but it was. She had apparently been having an affair with a coworker. When the police finally interviewed Don, he stated that he believed that Linda was having an affair and had run away with another man. I know. He said that on the last evening he had seen her, he noticed that a bag was missing along with many different items from the house. So, like, she packed something and left. Mm. He also claimed that a few days after Linda had initially disappeared, he had seen her in a van with another man. He said that he yelled out to her when he drove by this van and that Linda had ducked out of sight. In my opinion, though, this doesn't flow with the timeline for calling the cops and all that, like his timeline he gave, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But none of the theories that Dawn proposed sat right with the police, especially Michael Webb, who had been assigned to the case. First off, after interviewing all family and friends, it seemed that Linda had no enemies and no one who would have any animosity towards her. Mm-hmm. Well, other than Dawn.
Yeah.
And to them, they didn't seem like Dawn's stories didn't seem like stories that could explain where Linda went, but seemed more like stories that were trying to deflect suspicion off of oneself.
Yeah.
Yup. There was also another reason for the cops to not fully believe Dawn. Back in February of 1974, there had been an issue in his family. His mother and father had gotten into one of their arguments about alcohol and financial struggles to keep the family afloat, and his mother ended up shooting his father with a .38 caliber. His mother denied having actually shot his father, but eventually pleaded guilty to manslaughter and ended up serving 6 months. Mm. Though the incident didn't involve Dawn, it did serve as fuel for the cops to immediately look at Dawn as the prime suspect in Linda's disappearance. Mm-hmm. And also, it's always the husband.
Yeah.
But with no evidence linking Dawn to Linda's disappearance and no other evidence whatsoever, the case was pretty much put on hold and nothing came of it. So we fast forward 5 years to when a skull is found outside of Casa Gallardo. Mm-hmm. I mentioned it was found by two flight attendants. While the two had sat down to eat at a booth that had a nice window, they noticed a skull sitting outside of their window when they were eating, and it appeared to be looking right at them.
You know what's crazy?
What?
Is that usually at, like, authentic Mexican restaurants, that's how the decor is. It's, like, skulls,
yeah,
certain things.
Definitely was not the decor.
Really?
Because it was in a bush outside.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, like, if that were me, I might have thought it was the decor. Not if it was looking, like, right at me outside,
yeah.
But, like, maybe people saw it and thought it was, and that's why it took so long.
I mean, that does make sense. Mm-hmm. The skull was yellowing, though, and encrusted in dirt, which showed that it had been buried somewhere at some point and for some time. So at that point, it had been put on a shelf at the morgue and forgotten about, as I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So 14 months after the skull was found, on September 16th, 1991, the Vanita Park Police Department received an unsealed envelope. Inside of that envelope was a flyer for Casa Gallardo, and on the flyer was a stamp that said, quote, "The Bridgeton Police have L. Sherman's skull." The envelope was searched for DNA, but no fingerprints were left. And due to it being unsealed, no DNA was able to be taken from it. The skull was then tested and was compared to Linda's dental records, which ended up being a perfect match.
Wow.
This led to the case now becoming a homicide investigation. Now he's a lieutenant, so Michael Webb said about the skull being revealed to be Linda's, quote, I was rather astounded. It was obvious to me that someone wanted us to know that we had obviously missed something and was trying to tell us that Linda's remains had been recovered. Mm. Now that the investigation became one of homicide, the police began interviewing friends and family again. One of Don's ex-girlfriends was interviewed and said that Don had confessed to killing Linda, but again, there was not enough evidence to link him to the crime.
What the heck?
Once it was found that the skull belonged to Linda, of course, suspicions fell on Don. To add to the weirdness of this, that Mexican restaurant happened to be Don's favorite restaurant. And what's more, Don had been dining at that restaurant on the day that the skull had been discovered.
No.
So let's go over some of the suspects, or the one suspect. Mm-hmm. So Don, the husband, is our main suspect and was named the prime suspect by the St. Louis police. Like we went over, he was known for being physically and emotionally abusive as well as very controlling. Linda had filed a restraining order against him. And there was the fact that the skull ended up in the bushes in front of his favorite restaurant. Mm-hmm. And a restaurant that he visited sometimes three times a week. So like, his legit favorite restaurant.
That is so, so messed up.
And then there's the fact that she disappeared just 11 days after she filed for divorce. Dawn, on the other hand, is certain that the man he supposedly saw her with in that car is responsible. He believes that that man had killed her. This is somehow even more convincing in his mind, as somehow it was confirmed that Linda had indeed been having an affair with a co-worker shortly before she disappeared. Mm-hmm. So he has said, quote, I had nothing to do with Linda Sherman's disappearance or her death. I still think that she left with someone and obviously met with foul play and died. But what's weird about this is, why are you referring to your wife as Linda Sherman?
Yeah.
Like, why are you using her full name and
it's
not
like disassociating?
Right? Like, not the disappearance of my wife, like the had to do with Linda Sherman's disappearance. Like, that's just, I don't know.
Yeah, it's cold.
It just, like, I don't know. It's just weird.
Yeah.
Don also proposed the idea that maybe Linda was involved in a cocaine trafficking ring and that she was killed by someone who was afraid that she would turn and testify against them.
Wow, what a story.
John also apparently had an alibi, but I wasn't able to find out what this alibi was, but apparently he had some sort of alibi. Hmm. But investigators had a rather compelling theory. They believe that Don had murdered his wife sometime around April 12, 1985, which was right around the time that she was talking about actually going through with the divorce. Mm-hmm. He then buried the body and reported her missing. Ironically, the investigator said that they believed Don was having an affair, but realized that without a body to prove that his wife was dead, he would be unable to file for divorce and therefore unable to remarry.
Wow.
So if how I read this, in order to be able to file for divorce and, like, do it legally and everything, because, you know, you can't, like, marry multiple people, mm-hmm. your wife or whoever it is has to either, like, want to get a divorce as well. It has to be, like, a thing that both of you want to do, or they have to appear as dead.
Wait, so if your spouse passes away, you have to file for divorce?
No, if you want to, like, remarry, you have to prove that they died or something
like
that. Like
a death certificate
Gotcha. But, like, with her being, like, disappearing, he's not able to file for divorce unless she's dead. So when he realized this, he decided that he would find a way to show that Linda was indeed dead. He went and dug up her skull, placing it in a place where it would be found easily, his favorite restaurant. The plan would have worked out perfectly, and the skull would have been ID'd if it hadn't been for the fact that the police believed that the skull had come from the cemetery relocation project, so they didn't feel the need to run an analysis on it. Which means that the town just had a really shitty group leading it if they were just thinking, like, oh, a random skull that we found belongs to this project. I don't know. Well, months go by, and nothing comes up in the news about the skull being discovered, and nothing about his wife being connected to the skull. So 14 months later, Don writes the note to the police department, which led to the connection finally being made that the skull did indeed belong to Linda. Linda was officially declared dead at this point, which means that, at this point, Don would legally be allowed to remarry. So that's the investigator's theory, and I think it sounds like a really good theory.
Yeah, it matches Don's character for sure.
Yep. So no concrete evidence was found that would be able to link Don to Linda's murder, and he was technically ruled out as being a suspect, but like, dude. So, Lieutenant Mike Webb said that all of the evidence only pointed in one direction, and that's at Don. He says that Don is the only suspect that he is unable to eliminate. He said, quote, at this point in time, he has never been ruled out as a suspect. So, technically, he's been ruled out, but Michael Webb was like,
yeah,
I can't rule him out. Like, there's something about him.
Yeah.
Patty, her daughter, also believes that Don was the one who did it. She also can't think of a single other person who would have done this other than her father, which is horrible. So I mentioned how her skull was found, but the rest of her body never was. In 1999, Linda's skull was exhumed and was sent to Mercyhurst College in Erie, Pennsylvania, which is actually haunted, and I talked about in our Pennsylvania episodes. Go listen. So there had been some new technology that would allow the soil that had been collected on the skull to be tested for potential evidence, but sadly, not much evidence was found through this. The soil sampling did say, though, that her skull had been buried in a large wooded area in Missouri, in an area where there was purple morning glory, which is a flower. Mm-hmm. It was believed that this area was in Perryville, which is about 75 miles south of St. Louis, so police with cadaver-sniffing dogs and a search team were sent to that area to search for Linda's body. But nothing was found, and the case went cold again. Mm-hmm. Unsolved Mysteries covered Linda's case, and the episode aired on July 2nd, 2001, but again, no additional information came forward, and the case was still considered to be cold. Michael Webb, the lieutenant who was assigned to her case, worked on the case for over 20 years, even as he continued to climb the ranks in his department. The entire time, he kept trying to find out what happened and trying to get justice for Linda. For all those years, he fully believed that Dawn was responsible. Sadly, he passed away on February 4th, 2009. Mm. Linda's family tried to move on as best they could, with Dawn moving on the easiest. He remarried and started a new family. He died on May 7th, 2015, at the age of 58, at Good Samaritan Regional Health Center in Mount Vernon, Illinois. So if he knew anything, he took those secrets to the grave with him.
Wow.
And I read somewhere that in his obituary, he didn't mention Linda at all. He only mentioned his most previous wife. And he mentioned, his daughter was mentioned as the one and only, but not Patty, his wow. other daughter. So he mentioned his other daughter being his one and only daughter.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is sick.
Yeah. So due to this still being technically an open case, if you have any information at all about the death of Linda Lutz Sherman, please contact the Vinita Police Department in Vinita Park, Missouri at 314-499-6090 or Unsolved Mysteries at 1-800-876-5353.
Wow.
And that is the case of Linda Sherman.
Yeah, well, he for sure did it.
Oh my gosh, 100%.
I mean, his girlfriends at the time were saying he did.
Yes.
Like,
and just like... Okay, it's always the husband. I'm sorry, but it is.
Well, who's that one guy? Chris Watts is like the major story.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, Gabby Petito case doesn't mm-hmm. help. Like, if there's abuse going on,
mm-hmm.
it's not looking good.
And he was the last person to see her, like, when they had their argument.
Yeah.
And the whole story, like, the whole, like, her coming home and being agitated and all that stuff, that was all him telling the story.
Yeah.
So who knows what actually happened.
Yeah.
And it's clear that, like, she must have been seen the next morning because Patty does remember seeing her when she went to school, but she didn't move. So she was definitely not alive
exactly.
when Patty left that morning.
Yeah.
It's horrible.
Yeah, that's so sad.
Damn, Missouri.
I know. I wonder if his second wife was ever told anything.
I don't know.
That's very interesting.
I don't
know. It's sad.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for listening.
Thank you guys for listening. Yeah, two murders this week.
Yeah, I know. Usually we don't have that, but I was like trying to look for like haunted things in Missouri and I would find something, but it wouldn't be a long story. So
yeah.
I was like, oh my gosh, disappearances or like mysterious things. And I found this one. Sometimes I feel weird searching like disappearances in this state.
I know, where I'm like high profile murders and I'm like, what have I become that
right?
I'm searching this?
But I feel like if anyone ever searches our computers, we're like, look, we have a podcast.
I know.
We're not weird, I promise.
We'll need you guys to vouch for us.
Yeah, please. Well, follow us on all the social medias. Nora, what are they?
AscaryStatePodcast@gmail.com if you want to email us your scary listener tale stories, or follow us on Instagram at AscaryStatePodcast. And we are on Facebook too at AscaryStatePodcast.
Yes. And please rate and review us on iTunes. That would mean so, so much.
We'll give you a shout out if you review us.
All right. Well, thank you so much, guys. And stay scary. Oh my God. Stay scary.
Stay safe.